coming up on Weekend America.
Admit it, you didn't know who Barack Obama was a few years ago. Then you started to find out.
On the grounds, just outside the netting walls of the tent, Obama was walking along the walkways. And people simply stopped and spontaneously applauded as he walked by.
First impressions of the president-elect, including a memory of 18-year-old Barry Obama. I'm John Moe, also reading America's buildings.
When you think about death in some sort of accident, industrial or otherwise, rarely do you associate that with molasses.
And speaking of strange, a high school football team with the most unorthodox game plan you've ever heard.
It doesn't matter to us whether they think that a trick play is coming, because yes, it is. On every play, something different is going to be coming at you.
Two quarterbacks, 11 receivers, and wins. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Are you glad the election's over? Me, I'm just happy to watch TV and not see attack ads. At least when it's like something for Cheetos, no one has to approve of the message. We'll talk election this hour, but it's not all we'll talk about. We'll spy on your mailman as he spies on you. We'll read some buildings. Did we say read buildings? Yeah, that's right. And we'll learn about an abstract expressionist approach to high school football. See, even in football, there's change these days. Hey, Washington, D.C., are you feeling some post-election change?
I will relax more.
Actually, working in the Pentagon, for me, not too much, really.
I work in government relations, and I'm the token Democrat in the trade association. Yeah, it's money. And I don't mean money in a, I'm going to get money. I mean money in a colloquial sense.
I don't know. Have an Obama party.
What happens at an Obama party?
You know, everybody just come and celebrate. Finally got a Democrat in office. No more Bush. Just party.
Those voices came from the streets of Washington the morning after the election. Barack Obama was elected president on Tuesday, as you know. I followed this election closely. It was compelling. Strong characters like Sarah Palin and Reverend Wright and Joe the Plumber and Obama and McCain. There was conflict, high-stakes drama. I obsessed over every detail. I'm still trying to make sense of the big picture, though. In our nation, with a tradition of presidents named William and George and John, we just elected a Barack, whose last name is one letter away from Osama and whose middle name is Hussein. And who, yeah, is black. He's also the kind of person who gets elected president, though. Editor of the Harvard Law Review, constitutional law professor, freshman senator, but still, senator. It's telling that Obama is the author of a book, Dreams of My Father, about his quest for his own identity. Because no one with an identity like his has ever been president. Claire Peterski of Bellevue, Washington, learned Obama's identity earlier than most of us, in California in 1979.
I was at Occidental College, and he was too. We were both political science majors, both freshmen, and he was in my American Ideas and Institutions, Political Ideas and Institutions class, and he was in my discussion group.
I'm imagining an 18-year-old version of the guy that just got elected president, maybe in different clothes, but basically, you know, with the same focus and the same speaking style. How different was he?
I was personally a little bit intimidated by him because he said he went to, he lived in Hawaii, he went to a prep school. And I didn't come from as lofty a beginnings to think that, you know, oh, wow, he went to a prep school. He looked a little preppy, but he's also kind of laid back and Hawaiian. And, you know, he got along with everybody, unlike a lot of the other black students that only hung with the other black students. He seemed to be comfortable with everybody on campus.
Do you remember what kind of stuff he would talk about?
You know, a lot of poli-sci students, of course, are interested in politics and, you know, changing the world, especially when you're young and idealistic. And he was one of those people, too, that was very concerned about the issues. But he also was somebody who didn't just stop there. One of the things that struck me, because I read Dreams of My Father, and I thought he was awfully hard on himself when he talked about his Occidental College years, about how he didn't take things out into the world enough, because I thought, like, wow, you know, he was very active in politics and very active in the anti-apartheid work at Oxy, and I thought he did a lot.
Do you remember thinking, this guy could be the president of the United States one day?
No. He was just a bright, affable, nice guy, but I didn't think, oh, wow, he's going to be president one day.
Obama transferred out of Occidental. Claire didn't give him another thought until 2004, when Senate candidate Barack Obama spoke in support of John Kerry.
I was actually really shocked when I saw the Democratic National Convention, and I listened to that fabulous speech that so many of us have heard, and it suddenly hit me somewhere in the middle of it. Oh, my God, that's Barry. I mean, it just blew my mind.
Right. Whatever happened to Barry Obama?
Well, I found out.
I found out a while ago, too. I had heard of Obama. I saw that 04 speech. I thought, interesting guy, good speaker. Okay. Then I went to Austin, Texas, in October of 2006. I had been on a book tour, and it included a stop at the Texas Book Festival, where I was to appear in a panel discussion alongside David Rakoff, who you hear on our show all the time. David and I were to speak in the Capitol building in the Texas State Senate chambers. And as our audience assembled, I saw that it consisted of a few people there to see me and David, and then a bunch of disappointed-looking people in the back with folded arms and kind of scowls on their face who had tried unsuccessfully to get into the jam-packed event being held in the Texas State House chamber. That's where author Barack Obama was giving his talk. We were scheduled against Obama. And you know how on game shows, the winner gets like a new speedboat and the loser gets a case of turtle wax? David and I were turtle wax. And this was a big event. Lots of authors that you've heard of. And we were all turtle wax. David recalls it as well.
Don't you remember there just being this the charisma about him? We didn't even see the guy in the building. And the charisma was simply leaking down the hallways. Like gas.
Well, and we were ushered to a tent near the main building. That's where we were supposed to be signing our books. And I would say we got somewhere between a smattering and a trickle that day.
Yes, that's right. And it's quite steamy in the tent, although the sides are of transparent netting, which is meant to let the air go through.
Mm-hmm.
But then do you remember what happened? We were sitting in our chairs, and then on the grounds, just outside the netting walls of the tent, Obama was walking along the walkways. And people simply stopped on hillocks and lawns and in pathways and spontaneously applauded as he walked by.
I remember it kind of almost like a roar, like almost kind of a guttural moan of recognition of something there.
Yes. And it was weird. And I said it to you then or at some point. It was like a magnet going over iron filings. People just zinged in his presence. And I remember watching it through the netting walls of a tent. The fact that I saw him through cheesecloth almost accentuated the kind of it never happened quality of that whole day.
We saw him through gauze.
Yes. It was a gauzy memory.
Up until Election Day, Barack Obama was an abstraction. He was someone who could fix the economy or could turn it socialist, hope or threat. On Tuesday, the idea of Obama was replaced by President-elect Obama. America said, okay, go. Do what you promised. Boyd Reed was an Obama supporter and volunteer. This week, he stood in the voting booth and he thought about that reality.
I have a confession to make. I did not vote for Barack Obama today. I've openly supported Obama since March, but I didn't vote for him today. I wanted to vote for Ronald Woods. He was my algebra teacher at Clark Junior High in East St. Louis, Illinois. He died 15 years ago when his truck skidded headfirst into a utility pole. He spent many a day teaching us many things besides the Pythagorean theorem. He taught us about Medgar Evers, Ralph Abernathy, John Lewis, and many other civil rights figures who get lost in the shadow cast by Martin Luther King Jr. But I didn't vote for Mr. Woods. I wanted to vote for William A. Cross. She owned and operated Crossroads Preparatory Academy for almost 30 years, educating and empowering thousands of kids before her death in 2003. I was her first student. She gave me my first job, teaching chess and math concepts to kids in grades K through 4 in her summer program. She was always there for advice, cheer, and consolation. Miss Gross, in her own way, taught me more about walking in faith than anyone else I ever knew. But I didn't vote for Miss Gross. I wanted to vote for Arthur Mills Jackson, Sr. and Jr. Jackson, Sr. was a Latin professor. He has a gifted school named for him in my hometown. Jackson, Jr. was the preeminent physician in my hometown for over 30 years. He has a heliport named for him at a hospital in my hometown. They were my great-grandfather and great-uncle, respectively. But I didn't vote for Professor Jackson or Dr. Jackson. I wanted to vote for these people who did not live to see a day where a black man would appear on their ballots on a crisp November morning. In the end, though, I realized that I could not vote for them any more than I could vote for Obama himself. So who did I vote for? No one. I didn't vote. Not for president, anyway. Oh, I went to the voting booth. I signed, was given my stub, and was walked over to a voting machine. I cast votes for statewide races and a state referendum on water and sewer improvements. I stood there, and I thought about all of these people who influenced my life so greatly. But I didn't vote for who would be the 44th president of the United States. When my ballot was complete, except for the top line, I finally decided who I was going to vote for, and then decided to let him vote for me. I reached down, picked him up, and told him to find Obama's name on the screen and touch it. And so it came to pass that Alexander Reed, age 5, read the voting screen, found the right candidate, touched his name, and actually cast a vote for Barack Obama and Joe Biden. The vote will be recorded as mine, but I didn't cast it. Then again, the person who actually pressed the Obama box and the red vote button was the person I was really voting for all along. So no, I didn't vote for Barack Obama. I voted for a boy who now has every reason to believe he too can grow up to be anything he wants, even president.
Boyd Reed is a software tester in Turtle Creek, Pennsylvania. His essay first appeared on talkingpointsmemo.com. Tuesday night, people danced in the street, weeping, hugging each other. Have you ever seen that as a result of a presidential election? But it makes perfect sense. Here was a guy talking about how America is going to get better in a calm and reasonable way. In that sense, there was no way he was going to lose. Candidates who are more positive about what's ahead win. Look at JFK, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, now Obama. Here's something Barack Obama said Tuesday night. To all those who have wondered if America's beacon still burns as bright, tonight we proved once more that the true strength of our nation comes not from the might of our arms or the scale of our wealth, but from the enduring power of our ideals, democracy, liberty, opportunity, and unyielding hope. Hope he's right.
America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. You can learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com.
Okay, so yeah, there was some news this week. Tuesday, I think it was, something about a Maverick and some hope or something. Good news, bad news, no news, next on Weekend America. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Well, this is one week when we know that news happened. It's a big election. You might have heard about it. It's been on the radio. It's been in the newspapers. It's not the only thing that happened, but it was quite large. And here to help us sort out the news of the week into handy categories of good news, bad news, and no news is our panel, author Nancy French. Hello, Nancy.
Hi, John.
Comedian Dana Gould. Hey, Dana.
Hello.
And writer John Ridley. Hello, John.
Hey, John. How are you?
Good. Let's make the first topic nice and simple. Obama wins. Good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, I think it's bad news. I think it's a storm cloud, but with a major silver lining. And that silver lining is that John McCain isn't president.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Like so many anonymous advisors, the truth is coming out.
I know. Well, you know, I felt like it was the right thing to do to vote for McCain, and I did. And but he just wasn't conservative enough for me. And so I'm kind of glad that the Republican Party isn't saddled with leadership that is, you know, of his caliber. And I don't actually feel bad about Obama winning. I feel happy for them. I feel like I'm enjoying the moment. And I woke my kids up, you know, very late so they could see his acceptance speech. And, you know, it was very meaningful. But I'm not going to sit in the seat of scoffers until January 21st. And from this point until then, I just want to, you know, pray for him and hope that he does a good job.
I think it's good news, actually, for everything that Nancy said. I know that Nancy is politically and ideologically not aligned with Barack Obama, but the fact that all kinds of folks across America were waking up their children and looking at this moment, and even though they may not agree or be happy with the outcome of our democratic process, which is in and of itself great news, the fact that all kinds of people were able to realize that this is history.
It is my hope and it is my belief that he's smart enough to try to govern from the center, which is the only way I think he's going to get anywhere. And it's very bad news for comedians. Professionally, I am up a creek. A national sense of hope and optimism is very bad for my kind of comedy.
Can I say also, if you want to talk about the bad news of all this, as a Hollywood screenwriter, look, we made a lot of bank writing stories about what happens when they elect a black man president. What happens if a woman is president? Well, now we got it. That's a whole story structure that's gone.
Gone.
That we can't write about anymore. We got to sit around and think up original material. And quite frankly, we don't have that kind of time in Hollywood.
Next topic. With the election now over, anonymous McCain campaign staffers are harshly criticizing vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin. They're saying she didn't know that Africa was a continent and not a country. She didn't know which countries were involved in NAFTA. Is this anonymous sniping good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, I, for one, don't even believe the stories. I think, however, that it points out why McCain's honor/country theme didn't resonate, because his campaign was not a consistent theme.
You know, I would categorize this as no news, because politically I'm not a Sarah Palin supporter, and I would agree with Nancy. I don't know how much of this is true, how much of it is sort of sniping and the blame game, but I do believe that from the beginning, Sarah Palin was completely mishandled and mismanaged. You know, look, I'm a Green Bay Packers fan, and that means, you know, I don't want the Chicago Bears to win, but I can appreciate when they play a good game. And I would say with Republicans, you know, going forward, they need a Barack Obama badly. And Sarah Palin could have been that individual. And if they had rolled her out the way the Democrats had, making her a keynote speaker, you know, perhaps this year, and really introducing her and really getting her up to speed. But I certainly believe, top to bottom, the McCain campaign, I mean, just that gut check, Hail Mary, not vetted tokenism that she was reduced to destroyed her and destroyed his chances. You know, from here on, Sarah Palin is going to be looked at as sort of the illegitimate love child of Dan Quayle and Geraldine Ferraro.
So that's interesting. You have this.
I called her Ellie Mae Cheney.
You have this person who all these, you know, pretty awful things are being said about them, John, and you are sympathetic to the accused.
You know, Ronald Reagan got the diss of just being a vapid actor. You know, George Bush got the diss of just being this sort of empty suit. But ability and electability are two completely different things. Mm. And if she is a quick study, if she is a smart individual, and clearly to some degree she is, she could have been made into a better candidate. I will say for the last time, that is not an endorsement of Sarah Palin, but an acknowledgement of what it takes to get to the national spotlight.
Let me say, in the spirit of consensus and unity, You're both crazy. This is the greatest news of all time.
There we go.
This is like porn to me. I can't stop. I can't stop looking at it. Clearly, she engendered enough ill will to get these stories out and going. I'm not damning her on anything she supposedly did or said. The reason she filled me with such dread was that she brought back in full sail those nonsense culture wars. And she, with great relish and agility, dove back into real America and fake America and never showed to me in watching her, and, you know, I greeted her open-minded, a grain of humility about anything. That said, can she go off and rehabilitate herself and reinvent herself? Absolutely. Richard Nixon was dead in the water in 1966.
Yeah, that goes to my point. Is to me, it's the worst mistake you can make in life in general and probably in politics is writing these individuals off. And yeah. I think to me, that's the central issue, is if folks write her off and dismiss her, she can come back like a hydra.
Final topic. Immediately following the election, the Obama administration began to take shape with the hiring of Illinois Congressman Rahm Emanuel to be White House Chief of Staff. He's known for a tough, hard-nosed style. He's been a powerful figure in the House, often alienating to some people. What kind of news is that hiring?
That's no news. You know, that position requires a very stern, tough taskmaster. You're basically the quarterback of the team. Part of your job is regulating access to the president and making sure that everybody marches in unison and stays on message. And you need a guy with 9.5 fingers on the buttons at all times.
The reason why I think it's good news is because Mr. Emanuel's style is apparently, I think it's been described as a cross between a hemorrhoid and a toothache, famously. But he's not as... He's unexpected. Like in 2006, he recruited candidates who were relatively moderate on the social issues because, as John pointed out, he knew that they could win. And then I also like his stance on Israel. And so he's not exactly, you know, like out of the playbook of what a liberal might look like. And he seems like a smart guy.
Well, now it all makes sense. Now we understand the election and everything else. Panel, thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
Nancy French is the author of A Red State of Mind. Comedian Dana Gould's credits include The Simpsons. John Ridley is the editor-in-chief of ThatMinorityThing.com. By the way, you can vote on that question about anonymous Palin sniping at our website, WeekendAmerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
We have a story coming up that will change the way you see your mailman. It's all about how your mailman sees you. Ahead on Weekend America.
Thank you.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. The classic Marx Brothers film, Duck Soup, a movie devoid of both ducks and soup, is 75 years old this month. Weekend America producer Ocean Kalin didn't know much about the film or the man at the center of it, so he tracked down someone who does.
Did you ever dress up as Groucho for Halloween?
I did. I did dress up as Groucho when I was a teenager, probably soon after I'd seen Duck Soup. The black mustache and the glasses and the eyebrows. I had my cigar. I said, "Trick or treat!" And it was, I remember thinking it was almost a shame I had to carry a bag because Groucho didn't carry a bag. He had a cigar and that was it. So it seemed strange to me that I had to carry something for my candy. My name is Ari Hopman. I'm a lecturer at the University of Minnesota. I'm also a Marx Brothers historian. Most Marx Brothers aficionados consider Duck Soup to be the pinnacle, the best, the funniest of the Marx Brothers films.
Why? Why is it considered the funniest?
Mostly just because it's so funny. It has an interesting story. It's a political story. It's about how an incompetent person rises to the top of the government and makes a lot of ridiculous changes, and his advice is followed blindly.
Hello, members of the cabinet. We'll take up all business. I wish to discuss the tariff. Sit down. That's new business. No old business? Very well. Then we'll take up new business.
Now about that tariff.
Too late. That's old business already. Sit down.
Groucho has no respect for authority, but he's very much dependent on authority for his survival. So he seeks out these rich widows, usually played by Margaret Dumont, the same woman. And so she has a lot of money. Groucho professes his love to her, but insults her at every turn.
Can't you see what I'm trying to tell you? I love you. Why don't you marry me?
Why, marry you?
You take me and I'll take a vacation. I'll need a vacation if we're going to get married. Married. I can see you right now in the kitchen, bending over a hot stove. But I can't see the stove.
So his character, in a way, is a complete contradiction. Someone who needs rich society people, but is constantly tearing down the establishment.
My name is Spaulding, Captain Spaulding.
I am Roscoe W. Chandler.
Well, this is a treat, your treat. How would you like to finance a scientific expedition?
Well, that is a question.
Yes, that is a question. You certainly know a question when you see it. I congratulate you, Mr. Chandler. What is your opinion of art?
I am very glad you asked me.
I withdraw the question. This fellow takes things seriously. It isn't safe to ask him a simple question.
That character, over time, became him. The character overtook the person Groucho Marx.
Oh, off-screen, you mean?
Off-screen, yeah. So he became Groucho more or less, well, not 24 hours a day, but he would insult people in public. Sometimes people felt deprived if he didn't insult them. Being insulted by Groucho Marx became a sort of point of honor for some people. And he complained that it was very hard for him to give genuine insults because people always thought he was kidding.
That actually sounds pretty unpleasant.
Yeah. It was, I think it eventually became difficult for him to know where Julius Marx ended and where Groucho Marx began.
Julius Marx, that's his...
That's his real name, Julius Henry Marx.
Not that I care, but where is your husband?
Why, he's dead.
I'll bet he's just using that as an excuse.
I was with him till the very end.
No wonder he passed away.
I held him in my arms and kissed him.
Oh, I see. Then it was murder. Will you marry me? Did he leave you any money? Answer the second question first.
Mostly with Groucho, it's just the pleasure of laughter that he brings. Not everything he says is absolutely brilliant or hilarious, but, you know, he puts so much out there, and he was a very witty person, and so you just find yourself laughing a lot. People admire his lack of fear of institutions. It just doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter. His brother Chico said he would insult a king to make a beggar laugh, which I think is... I think says it all.
Marx Brothers historian Ari Hopman chatting with Weekend America producer Ocean Kalin. You know who really loves the Marx Brothers? Kids. Seriously, once they get past the weirdness of the black and white, every kid I know really digs it. Especially Harpo, as I'm sure you would expect. You can watch Duck Soup in its entirety on our website. You gotta love YouTube. Pop some popcorn, turn down the lights, head over to weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. A lot of focus on the executive and legislative branches of government this week with the election. But hey, let's not forget the judicial. This week, the Supreme Court heard arguments regarding fleeting expletives on television. Next week, another First Amendment case, Summum versus Pleasant Grove City. Pleasant Grove, Utah has the Ten Commandments in its public square, something already ruled legal. But now the Summum, a religious group, want to put their seven aphorisms next to the commandments. They say the government can't pick and choose religions to sanctify, that monuments are government speech. That kind of got us thinking about all the things monuments have to say around the country. So we went to find out. We start in Boise, Idaho.
In front of the Capitol building, there's a large metal statue, green flaked with corrosion. And on the plaque it reads, Frank Stunenberg, Governor of Idaho, 1897 to 1900, when in 1899, organized lawlessness challenged the power of Idaho, he upheld the dignity of the state, enforced its authority, and restored law and order within its boundaries, for which he was assassinated in 1905. Rugged in body, resolute in mind, massive in the strength of his convictions, he was of the granite hewn. In grateful memory of his courageous devotion to public duty, the people of Idaho have erected this monument.
On January 15th, 1919, a molasses tank at 529 Commercial Street exploded under pressure, killing 21 people. A 40-foot wave of molasses buckled the elevated railroad tracks, crushed buildings, and inundated the neighborhood. Structural defects in the tank combined with unseasonably warm temperatures contributed to the disaster. I'm surprised. I shouldn't laugh. But when you think about death in some sort of accident, industrial or otherwise, rarely do you associate that with molasses.
This is like a sort of a sheltered bus stop with a roof over it, and the words are actually printed right around the edge of this roof. So I'm going to have to walk around here to read it, but I will. It may be said I am in height 6 feet 4 inches, now I'm turning a corner, nearly, lean in flesh, weighing on an average 180 pounds, dark complexion, another corner there, with coarse black hair and gray eyes, no other marks or brands recollected. A. Lincoln, 12/20/1859.
I'm on the campus of Arizona State University in one of their academic buildings. There's a giant mural here with a bunch of Native Americans painted against a yellow background. And the Native Americans are in pairs. There's two of them side by side, and there's four sets. And they have these big rattlesnakes in their mouths that they're just like holding and chomping onto. And there's an inscription that reads, "Man's wisdom subdues the aggressive forces of nature." I didn't really understand what this is all about until I saw a tiny, tiny little plaque that read that this is to commemorate ASU's role in producing rattlesnake anti-venom.
I'm standing in Kelly Ingram Park, which is directly across the street from the Civil Rights Institute, here in Birmingham, and the Baptist Church, which was bombed in the 60s, which killed the four little African-American young ladies who were getting ready for church that day. I'm standing in front of a statue of a Caucasian police officer holding on to a black young man with a German Shepherd off its chain getting ready to attack this young man. This sculpture is dedicated to the foot soldiers of the American Civil Rights Movement. With gallantry, courage, and great bravery, they faced the violence of attack dogs, high-powered water hoses, and bombings. They were the fodder in the advance against injustice, warriors of a just cause. They represent humanity unshaken in their firm belief in their nation's commitment to liberty and justice for all. We salute these men and women who were the soldiers of this great cause.
When most people think of memorials, they think of wars or commemorating veterans. But on Chicago's north side, there's an entire park devoted to the Wizard of Oz and its creator. If you look around the Yellow Brick Road, which is the entranceway to the park, you'll see several memorials or dedications that people have purchased on single bricks that are on this Yellow Brick Road. There's a brick on the further end of the entrance that says, "Lynn, I love you. Will you marry me? Brad, 9/13/96. And the brick just adjacent to it says, "Yes, sweetheart. L."
That's Blair Chavis following the Yellow Brick Road in Chicago's Oz Park. We also heard from Adam Cotterell in Boise, Idaho, Rebecca Shear in Boston, Sarah McCammon in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Les Lavoy in Birmingham, Alabama. Okay, so the weekend, as it was designed, is supposed to be time off, right? You relax, or maybe you hit the town, maybe you just have some downtime. But not everyone gets the weekend off. And for them, we have our series Weekend Shift. Today, we're meeting someone in your neighborhood every Saturday, rain or shine, sleet or hail. You know who I'm talking about, the mailman or woman, the letter carrier. Reporter Kate Hines in New York recently found out that her mailman knew a lot more about her than she did about him. So she got to know him.
I often work from home. This means I sometimes take a special interest in my mail delivery, both to procrastinate or just to keep a lookout for a paycheck. So sometimes I'm around as my letter carrier stuffs my apartment building's 36 separate mailboxes.
And as you can see, these Netflix envelopes, they fit very, very well.
Let's call my mailman Marco.
It's great.
He's a compact 40-ish Bronx native with tinted glasses and a fondness for silver jewelry. And at first, that was pretty much all that I knew about him. But one day we struck up a conversation, and it quickly became clear that Marco knew far more about me than I did about him.
Okay, you're a vegetarian. I know the church that you belong to. Okay, I know your children's names. Also, knowing the church that you belong to, knowing of its liberal mindset as well, I can profile you by saying, yeah, you're a peace activist probably.
He was fairly on the mark, and it made me wonder, just what does Marco know about the people on his route? And is he paying attention to all of us?
Anybody that gets mail in the name of peace and goodness and humane society, all the things that I subscribe to, yeah, immediately I'm going to be attracted to, hey, these people are like-minded.
So one day Marco let me follow him on his route. It's a one-block section of a Manhattan street where he delivers mail to 1,900 different people. We started off in the lobby of my building where I asked him how he gleans information about his customers.
There are times when I'll see a customer one day, and I'll think, okay, perhaps it's their day off. Maybe they called in sick. Then I see them the next day, and the day afterwards, and the day after that. Then 2 weeks goes by, and 3 weeks goes by, and you're still seeing the person a lot, whereas you never saw them before on the street. And you say, oh boy, I won't be surprised if they've gotten laid off. And then about a week later, they get their first unemployment check, and you say, ah, I was right.
And suddenly, I'm seeing my block through Marco's eyes.
If I didn't see someone moving their car, I would think, oh boy, I hope everything is okay. Or if someone's mail backs up and they're not picking up their mail, yeah, you begin to think, gee, I hope that person's okay. And I've done it many times. I've gone, knocked on doors, and I've rung bells. And many times someone's, oh yeah, I just got the flu. I haven't gotten down to the mailbox, but gee, thank you for checking on me. Say, well, here's your mail. I hope you feel better.
Marco became a mailman out of necessity, not by choice. Although he took the various civil service exams after graduating high school, he initially wound up working as a technician in a hospital. It was a union position, and in 1984, he went on strike for 3 months.
And I had just gotten married, and I was out of work now, and so I got called for the Postal Service. And I says, you know what? I need a job, and I know I'll never go on strike doing that sort of work. And I don't want to be a mailman when I grow up, though, you know? And so there was that sort of struggle that I went through, but I took the job, and that was it. I mean, I went through terrific culture shock in the beginning, and it took a long, long time for me to get used to it.
A decade, to be precise.
And I just decided, hey, you know what? If you can't get out of it, get into it. And it was almost like an epiphany where I woke up the next morning and said, well, you know what? Now I'm going to be the greatest mailman in the whole world. And then I didn't call in sick for 10 years. I just applied myself and fell in love with my job, fell in love with my customers, and just fell in love with everything in the process.
But like all relationships, it can get routine.
And so every couple of years, I would allow myself to be transferred to a different street. Then the challenge was to have to now learn another 3,000 names and faces and so forth. And so that was fun until you get tired of it and you did it over and over again. And so you got to meet lots of different people.
People who, after 20 years of pushing a mail cart in the same two-block radius, Marco's come to think of as his neighbors.
You know, I spend more time here on this street than I do on the street that I live on. And this is my neighborhood in as much as it is yours.
And just recently, Marco told me that he was dating one of my neighbors. And how did it start? A conversation over a piece of mail. In New York, I'm Kate Hines for Weekend America.
If you're in the Pacific Northwest, hold on to your hats. Rain, flooding, general nastiness, cold fronts in the Northeast and South. Yikes. But there is fun to be had. Here's Jeannie Yandel.
Imagine a cross between a xylophone and a guitar, and you've got a hammered dulcimer. Imagine your world filled with hammered dulcimers, and you've got the Dulcimer Fall Festival in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. 51 and cloudy to tune and repair dulcimers and play them at the oddly exclusive Dulcimer Jam. The day culminates in a live, all-dulcimer version of the Metallica record Kill 'Em All. Okay, that's not true, but the Dulcimer Jam's for real. Elvis, big-eyed children, and poker-playing dogs have something in common. They've all been painted on black velvet. They're on display at Lake George, New York's Black Velvet Art Party. 56 and cloudy for psychic readings and velvet art costumes. And a silent auction for velvet paintings, so keep your opinions to yourself. The psychic readings will go like this. You think velvet paintings are cheesy. How do psychics do it? They're always right. Why am I suddenly talking so slowly? Because of Beatrice Alabama's cane syrup making day. 68 and sunny, which is good because you'll be outside for a while. They make cane syrup with mules and a hand-cranked furnace. Enjoy homemade barbecue that took 8 years to make. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
Piedmont High School's football team calls their offense the A11. We call it Bonkers. You'll find out why next on Weekend America.
Weekend America, supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at SplendidTable.org.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Last night, the Piedmont, California Highlanders played their homecoming game against the John Sweat Indians. That's not remarkable. What's remarkable is how Piedmont plays. They run this offensive strategy that is, well, it's crazy. So crazy, as the saying goes, it just might work. Reporter Roman Mars went to Piedmont to see what may be the future of football.
Tonight, is like everything is on the line. Piedmont tradition is built upon upsets. We got 31 Rudys on the team. We got 31 Rudys on the team. Nobody's giving us a chance tonight. Nobody's giving us a chance.
You've seen this movie. It's 4th and 10 and the bottom of the 9th, and Rocky has already been knocked down twice this round. Or something like that. But in the traditional narrative, the undersized underdog always has one ace up his sleeve, a trick play so cunning that it throws everyone for a loop. Now imagine that our underdog has 16,000 aces up his sleeve, and you'll begin to understand the appeal of the A11 high school football offense.
We are going to have a different shaped formation. We're going to make the defense think about what's happening. It doesn't matter to us whether they think that a trick play is coming, because yes, it is. On every play, something different is going to be coming at you. We want to make one of those great plays that wins the football game on every play.
That's Piedmont High School offensive coordinator Steve Humphreys. He and head coach Kurt Bryan developed the A11 offense as a way for their small school with generally smaller players to compete against some of the powerhouse teams in their division. From high above in the bleachers, the basic A11 formation looks something like this. Three receivers are out wide to the right. Three receivers are wide to the left. Then there's a center with two players on either side and two quarterbacks in the shotgun formation, 7 yards behind the center who snaps the ball. So there are players spread out the entire width of the field, and it eliminates that tight offensive line formation that we're used to seeing in football. All 11 players are potential receivers, hence the name A11. The defense doesn't know who is actually a downfield threat until the very last moment when the ball is snapped. And because there can be two quarterbacks, the defense doesn't even know who's getting the ball to begin with. It's fun and confusing to watch. And that's the point. When a Yale professor calculated the increase in the number of A11 offensive permutations as compared to the standard football formation, he got a result that even surprised Bryan and Humphreys.
It was from 36 to over 16,600 different combinations. And what's pretty neat about that is that it just lends itself to so much different strategy.
It creates 9, 10, or 11 one-on-one battles, little islands. So it's fun for the players because they never know who's going to touch the football, and it's very exciting for the fans to watch.
Yeah!
The Highlanders starting off with great field position in their patented A11 offense. Jeremy George is in the back.
Jeremy George, quarterback, and I'm a senior. Last year we had Ryan Lipkin. Both of us played quarterback, and he would get the snaps sometimes, and so I would be blocking, or I'd be faking to the right or something, and I'd let him throw the ball, and we worked really well together.
Did you think that when you were a quarterback at this team that you'd be blocking as the quarterback?
To be honest, I did not think I'd be blocking too much.
Let's go, D!
Tonight's opponent is Ensenal, a team that's 4-0 and probably has a 30-pound advantage on the average Piedmont Highlander.
They're really deadly. They're like a rattlesnake. They can just strike you. So we brought in a little rattlesnake rattle, right? And we tried to get the kids even extra fired up.
Two things you gotta do tonight. You gotta cut their head off. And then what do you gotta do?
Oh boy, I didn't hear that.
You gotta cut their head off. Then what do you gotta do?
They can't even hear you outside this locker room.
You gotta cut their head off. Then what do you gotta do? Am I clear?
Yes, go.
I can't hear you.
Am I clear?
Yes, go.
And this is the point where I have to tell you that they lost. I know. I wanted them to win so badly. But it didn't happen, because in the end, no matter what you try, the better team usually wins.
It goes to show that no matter how hyped up this offense is, you know, it's not perfect, and we're not perfect, and Ensenal is just the better team.
If we had lined up in a conventional offense all night against a team like Ensenal, they would just man up on us, and it would be brutal.
And that's the general consensus on this new experimental offense. The team doesn't win every time, but when they do lose, at least they're always in the game. And other small schools around the country, they've noticed.
Saddleback Valley Christian in Southern California is undefeated. They run a beautiful version of the A11. Madison County High in Alabama is 6-0. Right across the bay here, Mission High in San Francisco is doing well with it. there were so many coaches in the same boat as we were in, and so many teams where their players were in the same boat that our players are in, and this simply gives them a little bit better of a fighting chance.
After their loss against Ensenal, the Piedmont Highlanders went on to win the following three games and appear to be a lock for the playoffs again this year. After their season wraps up, the creators of the A11 offense, Kurt Bryan and Steve Humphreys, will be on the road teaching the method of their madness at coaching clinics across the country. In Piedmont, California, I'm Roman Mars for Weekend America.
By the way, the score from that game last night, Piedmont defeats John Sweat High School. Final score, 55-12. Their record now stands at 7-2. We've put a few photos on our website of Piedmont High running the A11 formation. You gotta see it. WeekendAmerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Julia Barton, Rob Byers, Sam Keenan, who's celebrating his son's 6th birthday this weekend. Ben Adair is taking his son to the beach this weekend. Have fun, dads. Michael Rayfield, Chrissy Clark, Michael May, Sasha Aslanian, who's flying to West Virginia, Angela Kim, who's flying to Washington, D.C., Hillary Frank, Brendan Noonan, Ocean Kalen, Ariel Kitch, Mark Sanchez, playing with the band Les Ours at the 331 Club in Minneapolis, and Chris Wieg, who plans to go see the movie Synecdoche, New York. But he's not going to Schenectady, New York to see it. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program from our website, weekendamerica.org. You can also go to iTunes, find the podcast there, and enjoy your weekend with us. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Weekend is the perfect time to sit back and reflect.
There is some kind of sense of isolation and desolation that makes it like a dream moving around in some of these landscapes.
Look, traveling all across this nation can get expensive. Let us do it for you. I'm John Moe, host of Weekend America. Every week we take you across the country and show you what your friends and neighbors are doing and thinking. Join us.